Welcome, everyone, to a brand new deep dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and our mission today is, well, it's ambitious. We are tackling the entirety of the Wall Street Journal for Monday, November 3rd, 2025.
And I'm Sam Astor. Ambitious is definitely the word.
Yes.
We've pulled together a really comprehensive, I'd say exhaustive, stack of sources today. Covers everything from, you know, these big shifts in the U.S. labor market, a major corporate accounting scandal heating up,
all the way to global conflict points flaring up, and even this kind of internal identity crisis happening within the Democratic Party.
Exactly. So much ground to cover.
That's right. And our goal, as always, is to give you, the learner, a full detailed report of the day's most critical news. But more than that, we want to explore its broader implications for you. We're distilling this entire paper down into key actionable insights across finance, politics, culture.
Helping you understand not just what happened in the headlines, you know, but the context behind it, the bigger forces at play. So we're going to kick things off today by looking right at the heart of the American economy, the workforce. We'll be discussing some major shifts happening in labor, the comeback of a controversial product in housing, and these corporate streamlining moves that are really changing how big companies operate right now.
Okay, let's jump right in then. Starting with something that feels like a really fundamental shift in how companies are behaving, we're calling it the end of the firing freeze.
Right. So for years, really since the pandemic rebound started, U.S. businesses were super hesitant to let workers go, even if they weren't, you know, the most productive employees.
They were spared they couldn't hire them back if things picked up, right? This labor hoarding idea.
Exactly. Economists called it labor hoarding.
Mm-hmm.
And the core finding in the journal today is that corporate America has pretty much stopped doing that, that reluctance. It's gone.
The hoarding period is over.
It's over. Now that the job market has softened up a bit and we have real data on this, employers feel, well, safer letting people go to boost efficiency. We saw the unemployment rate tick up, didn't we? It hit 4.3% in August.
Yeah, up from that low of 3.4% back in April 2023. That's a noticeable jump.
Yes. And this isn't just economists talking theory either. You're seeing big household name companies making moves. Tens of thousands of layoffs announced recently.
We're talking giants, right?
Yeah.
Amazon.com, UPS, Target, even Meta platforms. These aren't small tweaks. They're significant strategic cuts.
Definitely strategic. And it signals this deeper philosophical shift in corporate thinking. Joseph Brusuelas, he's the chief economist at RSM. He points out it's starting to feel a lot more like the 1990s again.
The 90s? How so?
Well, back then, efficiency was king. Companies got rewarded big time by investors for cutting workers they deemed, well, unnecessary. That laser focus on trimming the workforce to pump up the profit margin, it's clearly back. It's replacing that cautious, we can't find people mindset from the last few years.
So, okay, the labor market's softer, that's one reason. But what else is driving this wave of layoffs now?
Well, it sounds a bit ruthless, maybe, but it boils down to the balance sheet. Labor is usually the biggest operating cost for most businesses.
Simple as that. Cut costs, boost profits.
It's the quickest way. We saw it with Target, right? They announced cutting 1,800 corporate jobs. And the incoming CEO was very direct, said something like, too many layers and overlapping work have slowed decisions.
Cutting the fat, basically.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. And we absolutely cannot ignore the AI factor here. Artificial intelligence.
Right. That's looming large everywhere.
Huge. The optimism around AI is playing a massive, maybe even an accelerating role. The Fed's latest beige book, their economic report, mentioned that more employers are cutting headcounts, specifically citing, in some cases, increased investment in artificial intelligence technologies. That's why they feel comfortable doing it now.
That's fascinating because it's happening before the AI is even fully rolled out in many places, isn't it?
Exactly. It's the belief, the anticipation, that AI will eventually replace big chunks of the workforce, especially those higher wage analytical jobs. That belief makes them okay with ditching the labor hoarding now.
Jed Coloco at the Peterson Institute pointed this out too, right? Said it was really pronounced in high wage sectors, tech, finance, professional services, the jobs most likely impacted by AI.
That's the key thing. The most expensive employees, the ones who were hardest to find a couple of years ago, they were the ones being hoarded the most. And now, that's where the cuts are happening first. Boards are looking at it like, why keep a pricey team of 20 analysts if we think an AI platform can do 80% of that work in 18 months?
And investors, how are they reacting?
They love it. Investors are welcoming the cuts. Target stock ticked up a bit on their news. Amazon's stock rose 1% when they announced 14,000 layoffs. The market sees this as good for the bottom line, plain and simple.
But okay, connect this back to the wider economy. If investors like it, fine. But what's the risk here? August job growth was already really slow. What was it, 22,000 jobs added?
Barely anything.
Right. So if these layoffs pick up speed, couldn't we go from slow growth to actually losing jobs overall? That feels like a real danger.
That is absolutely the tightrope the economy is walking.
Yeah.
Corporate efficiency, better profit margins, great for stocks, great for the S&P 500. But widespread layoffs, that could crush consumer demand, which is, you know, like 70% of the U.S. economy.
So the stock market and the job market are kind of pulling in opposite directions.
You got it. Financial markets cheerleading, while the labor market shows warning signs.
Okay. Speaking of consumers feeling the pressure, let's pivot straight to the housing market. Still incredibly tough out there. Affordability is just brutal.
Yeah, and because of that, we're seeing the return of something many people probably hoped was gone for good. The adjustable rate mortgage, or ARM.
ARMs are back. Why now?
Because buyers are desperate.
Oh.
Utterly desperate for affordability. Home prices are up, what, over 50% since just 2019. Near all-time highs. But fixed mortgage rates are still stubbornly high, near 6%, sometimes higher. For the past year or so, people are just hunting for any way in.
And the ARM mechanism, just to refresh, it gives you a lower initial rate than the standard 30-year fix, right?
But then it resets.
Oh, that's right.
Usually after 3, 5, 7, maybe 10 years. And if market rates have gone up by then, your monthly payment could shoot way up. Suddenly, the house might not be affordable anymore.
So it's a gamble.
It's absolutely a gamble buyers are making right now. The average 30-year fixed rate in late October was around 6.15%. But you could get a 5-year or 7-year ARM for maybe 5.46%.
Okay, that difference, almost 70 basis points. That's real money each month.
Hundreds of dollars saved every month. The article mentions a couple in D.C. buying a townhome. They specifically chose a 5.25% 7-year ARM over a fixed rate around 5.875%, just to save those crucial hundreds monthly.
And the borrower, Kyle Everett, was quoted saying it was a no-brainer to take the ARM. He's betting the Fed keeps cutting rates over the next few years.
So they can refinance into a lower fixed rate before that reset hits.
Exactly. So it's not just a bet on housing. It's a bet on where Fed policy is headed. Makes sense. Because 30-year fixed rates usually track long-term yields, like the 10-year Treasury, right?
Right. But ARMs are more tied to short-term rates. And the Fed did cut short-term rates recently.
Right.
So there's this sort of collective feeling among borrowers, maybe lenders too, that rates are more likely to drift down than shoot back up in the next few years. That confidence is what's fueling this ARM comeback.
ARMs, for anyone who remembers the mid-2000s, that word triggers some serious anxiety.
Oh, absolutely. PTSD almost.
Back in 2004, 2005, something like a third of all mortgages were ARMs. And when those low intro rates reset higher, millions defaulted. It was a huge factor in the housing collapse, the Great Recession. Why shouldn't we be worried now? Is this time really different?
Thankfully, the risk is genuinely lower today. Today's ARMs are way less risky than those subprime versions that blew everything up. Lending standards are much tighter now, thanks to reforms after 2008. Lenders can't just offer those crazy teaser rates that explode upwards immediately.
And they have caps, right? Limits on how much the rate can change.
Exactly. Almost all ARMs today have caps on how much the interest rate can adjust each year and over the entire life of the loan. So there are guardrails, but still. Even with safeguards, ARM usage is the highest it's been since 2023. It's about 10% of purchase applications now.
And builders are noticing. D.R. Horton mentioned 14% of their buyers used ARMs recently.
They're leaning into it. People want to own, but they need that temporary window of affordability. Right now, ARMs are providing it.
It really paints a picture, doesn't it? Middle class getting squeezed, companies cutting jobs to boost profits, consumers reaching for riskier loans just to get by.
That's the dynamic. Okay, so that covers some of the pressure on consumers and workers. Let's shift gears now. Pivot sharply over to the world of big corporations, finance giants, and some legal trouble brewing there, starting with the Oracle of Omaha.
Berkshire Hathaway. Always fascinating. What's the news there?
Well, big news, actually. Berkshire reported a pretty significant 17% jump in quarterly earnings, which is major considering their sheer size. And this boost, driven mostly by their huge insurance businesses. Operating profit there more than doubled year over year. Kind of surprised analysts.
Insurance did well? Any particular reason?
A big factor was, ironically, something totally out of their control. The weather. It was a mild hurricane season in the U.S. during August and September.
Ah, so fewer big payouts for their reinsurance arms.
Exactly. When storms are calm, Berkshire's reinsurers hold on to those premiums instead of paying out massive claims. Simple as that. good weather equals good profits for them.
Beyond luck with the weather, any internal improvements?
Yeah, their big auto insurer, Geico, showed a real turnaround. Premiums were up slightly, margins improved, probably due to them ramping up ad spending again, plus maybe better underwriting. Analysts noted Geico kind of has this history of turning the ad spending spigot on and off based on how they're doing financially.
Sounds like the spigot is definitely on right now.
Looks that way, trying to grab back market share. But the real headline grabber, and maybe a source of some jitters for investors, is the cash pile.
Oh, right. Berkshire's famous cash hoard. How big is it now?
Record-breaking. Cash and equivalents hit an incredible $358 billion at the end of September. That's up from $344 billion just back in June.
$358 billion?
Wow.
And Buffett's not spending it?
Nope. He's passing on big stock buybacks again, Fifth Street period, with no repurchases and no major acquisitions announced either. He's just sitting on it.
Which is unusual for him, isn't it? Especially when markets might look a bit cheaper.
Highly unusual. He's usually aggressive when others are fearful. Some analysts are speculating. Maybe he's deliberately leaving those huge deployment decisions, decisions that could really move markets to his successor.
Greg Abel, right. Who's taking over as CEO at year end as Buffett steps down. He's 95 now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that succession is causing real anxiety on Wall Street. Since they announced Abel would take the CEO role back in May, Berkshire's Class A shares are down about 12%. That's significantly underperforming the S&P 500.
So investors are nervous about the transition and maybe the lack of transparency that comes with Berkshire.
That's the theory. Berkshire's famously opaque, right? No quarterly earnings calls, no specific financial guidance like other huge companies. The immense faith investors had was always fundamentally faith in Buffett himself, his judgment, his integrity.
Can Abel command that same level of trust?
That's the billion-dollar question, or maybe the $358 billion question. Mm-hmm. Analysts at Keefe, Bruyette & Woods actually downgraded Berkshire recently to underperform. They explicitly said this lack of transparency will weigh on the stock if investors aren't willing to give Abel the same kind of, well, blind faith they gave Buffett.
Interesting times ahead for Berkshire. Okay, from the rock-solid finances there, let's dive into something completely different. A massive corporate collapse. The First Brands Group story.
Oh, this is a big one. The auto parts giant, First Brands, went into Chapter 11 bankruptcy. And it's not just a simple failure. There are allegations of widespread fraud. It's even triggered a criminal investigation by the Justice Department.
Wow, and the auditors are right in the middle of it.
Squarely in the spotlight. The company's auditor was BDO USA. And BDO signed off on First Brands' 2024 financials just months before this whole thing blew up. Now, court documents are emerging showing massive discrepancies between what BDO certified and, well, reality.
What kind of discrepancies are we talking about?
Huge ones. The BDO audit noted about $5.23 billion in corporate debt. But it seems they missed, or at least failed to properly detail, billions more in off-balance sheet debt.
Off-balance sheet? Like what?
Including $2.3 billion related to something called accounts receivable financing. That's where a company borrows money against payments its customers owe it in the future.
Okay. And that should have been disclosed?
Experts are saying absolutely yes, especially given the scale. Those off-balance sheet deals were material and needed prominent disclosure. First Brands' own restructuring advisors, brought in after the bankruptcy, later found the total debt was actually $11.63 billion.
Nearly double what BDO signed off on.
Almost double. And it gets worse. The new management team also said nearly $2 billion in physical assets were just missing, vanished.
Missing assets? This sounds like outright fraud.
That's what the allegations point to. And it's led to this massive legal fight now. Creditors are battling over a proposed $4.4 billion rescue loan, a DIP loan, debtor in possession being offered by hedge funds like Monarch and Mudrick.
Why the fight over the rescue loan? Isn't that supposed to help?
The fight is about how it's structured. Specifically, a $3.3 billion chunk of it is a roll-up.
A roll-up? What's that?
It basically takes existing debt already held by these hedge funds and converts it into this new super priority DIP loan. This move puts the hedge funds at the very front of the line to get repaid ahead of almost everyone else, including other creditors.
Ah, so the hedge funds jump the queue.
Exactly. And the other creditors are furious. They argue that the debt being rolled up is already trading for pennies on the dollar, like 40 cents, which shows how distressed it is. They say approving this DIP loan basically guarantees that the victims of the alleged fraud will get little or nothing back because the hedge fund's questionable debt gets paid first. They called the structure egregious. A blatant self-deal.
This raises huge questions about the auditors, BDO, doesn't it? How could they miss so much?
Massive questions. BDO's defense is essentially that auditing isn't a forensic investigation. It's not designed to catch all fraud. But when you're talking billions in off-balance sheet debt and missing assets discovered months after you gave the all clear, it puts intense scrutiny on their process. Did they really exercise professional skepticism like the standards require? Were they independent enough for management?
It shakes confidence in the whole system of financial oversight.
Absolutely. This will have fallout for a long time.
Okay, let's broaden out now to the wider private equity world. They've had a tough few years with high rates slowing down deals. How are they doing now? We saw news from the Carlyle Group.
Right. Carlyle's third quarter profit took a significant hit. Fell quite a bit.
Why is it quite a drop?
Mostly because asset sales, what they call exits, slumped pretty badly. It shows the recovery in deal-making after the three-year downturn is still really uneven across the industry. Carlyle's distributable earnings, that's the actual cash they give back to their investors, missed analyst forecasts. Stock dropped almost 6% right after the report.
Not great news, but the CEO sounded optimistic.
Harvey Schwartz, yeah, he struck a surprisingly positive tone. He basically argued the miss wasn't due to bad assets, more about the timing of when deals actually close, which can be unpredictable. He tried to reassure investors, pointing out Carlyle still returned a solid $19 billion over the past year, and they have another $5 billion in deals already signed, just waiting to finalize.
So don't worry, the pipeline is still good.
That was the message. And that optimism is echoed elsewhere, like at Blue Owl Capital. They focus heavily on private credit, lending money directly to companies.
And they had to address the First Brands collapse too, right? Since that involved debt.
Exactly. And another bankruptcy, a subprime auto lender called Tricolor. Blue Owl's co-CEO, Mark Lipschultz, specifically tried to calm investors about those.
What was his take?
He argued forcefully that both First Brands and Tricolor were purely idiosyncratic credit issues, meaning they fail because of specific problems like suspected fraud in First Brands' case, not because there's some systemic rot or widespread problem in the broader credit market.
So isolated incidents, not a canary in the coal mine.
That's his argument. He even used this interesting phrase, called the market's nervous reaction, the Mandela effect of finance.
The Mandela effect, like the false memory thing.
Yeah. He's saying investors have this shared but false memory or feeling of a looming credit crisis. They're working themselves up about an imaginary systemic problem that isn't really there. Meanwhile, Blue Owl reported strong earnings from their core fee-generating business, even though overall net income dipped. Their message, the underlying business is healthy.
Interesting times for private markets. Okay, let's quickly run through a couple other corporate updates before we move on. Hormel Foods.
Hormel, yeah, they cut their earnings forecast for the fourth quarter, facing some serious headwinds.
What kind of headwinds?
A nasty combination, really. First, ongoing price pressures on key inputs, beef, pork. Second, the bird flu, highly pathogenic avian influenza hitting the poultry industry, especially turkeys. And third, they had a fire damage their peanut butter plant in Little Rock.
Oof, a triple whammy. And their CFO is leaving.
Yes, Jolson Smiley is stepping down, though the company made a point of saying it wasn't due to any financial disagreements.
Okay. And finally, Crocs. The shoes everyone loves or loves to hate.
Crocs. Their Q3 profit was actually down compared to last year, but they managed to beat what analysts were expecting. Suggests their turnaround plan might be starting to work. Just a little.
What's the plan?
They've been really aggressive about cutting back on promotions, discounts, and reducing their inventory to match demand better. That helps margins. But the big challenge is the Hey Dude brand they bought.
Yeah, the casual shoe brand. Not doing well.
Revenue there fell a lot, down 22% in the third quarter. Seems like maybe product fatigue set in, or they didn't diversify enough beyond that main slip-on style. Crocs is now having to lean hard on new products and partnerships, like one with the NFL, to try and get Hey Dude growing again.
Okay, got it. All right, moving away from corporate balance sheets and earnings reports now. Let's shift focus sharply over to the pretty volatile world of U.S. and global politics. Lots happening there, starting with something painful right here at home.
Yeah, we have to talk about the U.S. government shutdown. It's still going on. Dragged on for over a month now.
Getting close to that record, isn't it?
Yeah.
The 35 days from 2018-2019.
Creeping closer. And the impact on regular Americans is getting worse, becoming much more noticeable.
What's the main sticking point politically? Still the health care subsidies.
It really seems to hinge on the Affordable Care Act, the ACA subsidies. Democrats are insisting making it a non-negotiable condition, it sounds like, right, that the enhanced subsidies, which are set to expire, must be extended to end the shutdown.
Because if they expire, millions could see their health insurance premiums jump.
Sharply higher bills, yeah.
Yeah.
Right in the family budget. But the pain is spreading far beyond just healthcare talks now. We're seeing reports of crazy long airport delays. Newark, Houston flights delayed over 3 hours on average last Sunday. Why? Staffing shortages, partly due to the shutdown.
And essential services, food aid.
SNAP, the food stamp program, is at serious risk. Serves over 40 million people. Contingency funding is running low. You could get cut off entirely if this drags on.
And the political rhetoric. Predictably heated, I assume?
Oh, yeah. Intense. Highly partisan. Democrats are blasting the administration, urging President Trump to step in and stop what they're calling the wrecking ball, accusing the White House of freezing funds for services, maybe targeting blue states. Senator Tim Kaine said if the president just engaged, they could get a deal in hours.
And the Republican side?
Republicans, led by Speaker Mike Johnson, are firing back, accusing Democrats of holding the American people hostage by tying the government reopening to these health care demands. Meanwhile, the administration is being forced by judges to use emergency funds to keep SNAP going, but those funds aren't endless.
There's also an editorial angle on those ACA subsidies, right? About state budgets.
Yes, the editorial board makes a key point. Extending these sweetened ACA subsidies, which started back in 2021, basically incentivizes states and cities, especially those with huge pension and retiree health care debts, to shift those costs onto the national taxpayer.
Like a backdoor bailout.
That's what they're calling it. Cities like Chicago, Detroit, San Bernardino have apparently already done this, moved retirees onto the ACA exchanges to save their local budgets billions. The argument is, if Congress makes these subsidies permanent, more broke cities will follow, pushing an older, sicker group onto the ACA exchanges.
Which drives up premiums for everyone else on the exchanges.
Exactly. That structural issue is a big part of what the GOP side is resisting.
Okay, a complex mess. Now, shifting gears completely within politics to a really bizarre and frankly disturbing story. The FDA official scandal.
Yeah, this one is wild. The recently hired head of the FDA's main drug division, Dr. George Tidmarsh, resigned very abruptly. Why? He got sued by a drug company, Aurinia Pharmaceuticals.
Sued for what?
It's a tangled story. Allegations of retaliation, market manipulation, even attempted extortion. Aurinia claims Tidmarsh used his new powerful FDA position to deliberately tank their stock price through a public post on LinkedIn, of all places. He wrote something negative about their kidney drug, Mucilaginib, a drug the FDA itself had already approved. The post wiped out something like $350 million in Aurinia's market value almost instantly.
An FDA official publicly trashing an FDA-approved drug on LinkedIn? That sounds highly irregular.
Unprecedented is the word being used. Tidmarsh claimed later he was speaking personally, not officially. But the damage was done. The stock plunged 20% immediately.
And Aurinia says this wasn't just a random comment. There's history here.
They allege it's part of a years-long campaign of retaliation against their board chair, Kevin Tang. Apparently, Tang had pushed Tidmarsh out of a CEO job at another company, Lajala Pharmaceutical, back in 2019. The lawsuit even includes nasty messages Tidmarsh allegedly sent Tang back then, like, are you enjoying failure? Get used to it. Shows real personal animosity.
Okay, so bad blood. But how does that connect to extortion?
This is where it gets really bad. The lawsuit claims that after Tidmarsh joined the FDA in August, his personal lawyer emailed Tang. The email apparently suggested they needed to extend a lucrative payment deal that had been set up years ago between Tidmarsh and a company Tang leads.
Wait, his lawyer contacted the guy he supposedly has a vendetta against right after he allegedly tanked the stock using his FDA connection to talk about a payment deal.
That's what the lawsuit alleges. And it explicitly labels that email an attempt to extort and solicit a bribe. Basically leveraging the damage he caused and his new position for personal financial gain. The audacity is just stunning.
Has Tidmarsh responded?
His lawyer denies the bribe claim, says the email was taken out of context. But the facts are, the relevant government ethics offices, HHS General Counsel, Inspector General, were alerted about serious concerns about his personal conduct. He was put on leave and then he resigned very quickly.
Wow. That casts a serious shadow over the FDA's leadership and ethical oversight. Needs more investigation for sure.
Absolutely. Huge questions raised there.
Okay, let's look ahead now to some upcoming elections. These seem poised to really highlight this ongoing debate, this identity crisis within the Democratic Party. We're talking Virginia, New Jersey, New York City.
Right. These elections, especially the governor races in Jersey and Virginia, are expected to deliver what the Journal calls a muddled verdict on that central question for Democrats. Do they need to tack moderate to win swing voters or go more progressive to fire up the base and tackle inequality?
Let's look at New Jersey first. The governor's race there is between Republican Jack Ciattarelli and Democrat Mikey Sherrill. It's tightened up.
Narrowed significantly, yeah. And the campaign narrative is all about affordability, property taxes, rising energy costs, kitchen table issues.
And Ciattarelli, the Republican, has a tough balancing act.
A really tricky one. He needs the MAADA base to turn out he got Trump's endorsement earlier this year. But New Jersey has way more registered Democrats, like 800,000 more, so he absolutely needs independents. And Trump is still very unpopular with many of them.
Didn't Ciattarelli used to be more critical of Trump?
He did. He once called Trump a charlatan, unfit for office. Now, he's had to move closer to the Mangier wing after being seen as more moderate for years. That potentially makes his message confusing or unpalatable for some of those crucial swing voters.
And Sherrill, the Democrat, what's her strategy?
She's a former Navy pilot, playing up her background. And she successfully nationalized the race, basically trying to make it a referendum on Trump. She hammers Ciattarelli constantly for his Trump ties, even on local stuff like that huge gateway train tunnel project under the Hudson River, which Trump had threatened to kill.
Okay, so that's Jersey. Now New York City. That seems like a different dynamic entirely.
Totally different. You've got Zohra Namdani, a Democratic socialist, as the front runner for mayor, and his platform is pure economic populism.
Like what specifically?
Mandated citywide rent freeze, free city bus rides for everyone, universal public child care, and a really ambitious goal, a $30 minimum wage by 2030.
$30 an hour. Wow. That's where the internal Democratic fight really comes into play, isn't it?
Absolutely. Centrist Democrats are genuinely worried. They fear if Mamdani wins, Republicans will have powerful ammunition to paint the entire Democratic Party as moving towards socialism.
They see it as a potential liability nationwide.
Exactly. Centrist groups are warning explicitly, saying the party will have to carry the baggage of a highly radical left-wing socialist mayor into the next election cycle. They see it as similar to how the Defund the Police slogan hurt Democrats in 2020 and 2022, gave the GOP an easy attack line about being weak on crime.
And the fear is a Mamdani win might encourage more progressive primary challenges against moderate Democrats in swing districts?
That's the core fear. Primary challenges against incumbents who might be more electable in purple districts, potentially costing the party seats nationally.
But the progressive wing argues.
They argue the opposite. They say the party needs inspiring candidates like Mamdani with bold populist ideas to actually connect with working-class voters and address crushing problems like inequality. It's a running stand-for-nothing centrist just fails to motivate the base.
You can really feel the tension in the party.
It's incredibly real. The article cited a recent Pew poll showing 2/3 of Democrats and Dem-leaning independents say their party makes them feel frustrated. That's way higher than just a few years ago. So yeah, the results in these three elections, NJ, VA, NYC, will really send signals about which direction the party might lean heading into the midterms.
Okay, moving from domestic politics now to the global stage and some serious conflict zones. Let's start with Gaza. The efforts to establish some kind of peace or stability there face huge hurdles, especially this idea of an international security force.
Monumental hurdles. The challenge for diplomats is really twofold. First, just getting countries to actually commit troops. Second, figuring out what that force would even be allowed to do without blowing up the whole fragile peace process.
How many troops are we talking about?
The proposal is for maybe up to 5,000 troops, mostly from Arab and Muslim majority nations, plus another 2,000 to 3,000 Palestinian personnel who would be trained elsewhere, like Egypt and Jordan.
But countries are hesitant to sign up.
Deeply hesitant. The biggest fear. If this international force actually has to confront Hamas militants inside Gaza, say, dismantle command posts or weapons caches, they'll immediately be branded by their own populations back home as an Israeli proxy force.
And that would be politically toxic for those governments.
Hugely destabilizing. And Hamas isn't making it easy. During the recent truce, their fighters came out, started consolidating power, even publicly executing rivals they accused of collaborating. They're insisting on having a major role in post-war governing.
What are they saying about the security force?
They have apparently told Egyptian intelligence they'd only accept a force stationed strictly at the borders, not one that would operate inside Gaza and potentially challenge their authority.
And who might actually send troops? Any takers?
Turkey, Pakistan, Azerbaijan, Indonesia. They've apparently expressed some initial interest, either in sending troops or just providing funding. But that immediately creates other problems. Israel, for instance, has strongly objected to Turkey participating.
Why Turkey?
Given President Erdogan's very harsh anti-Israel rhetoric recently, plus historical links between some Turkish groups and Hamas-aligned factions. So the whole project to bring in an international force to stabilize Gaza is facing massive roadblocks. Could easily stall out completely.
Okay, shifting regions now to the Caribbean. There's this ongoing situation with the Trump administration conducting lethal military strikes against suspected drug boats. What's the latest there?
The administration is digging in on its legal position. They're asserting they can continue these strikes, which have killed people, without needing specific permission from Congress under the War Powers Resolution.
How are they justifying that? Don't military actions usually require congressional authorization?
They're using a, let's say, controversial interpretation. They claim the strikes, mostly done by drones, don't count as hostilities under the law because U.S. personnel aren't directly endangered. The drones hit the boats far away from any U.S. ships. They're citing some older legal opinions from the 80s and 90s to back this up, arguing it's not sustained combat against another country.
How many strikes have there been?
The report says about 65 people killed in 15 separate airstrikes so far in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific. The administration labels the targets the drug cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, or FTOs. They frame it as part of a conflict against these non-state terror groups.
But Congress isn't buying it.
There's growing pressure, and it's bipartisan. Senators on key committees like Armed Services and Intelligence are frustrated by the lack of transparency and the legal reasoning. Senator Mark Warner complained the administration briefed only Republicans on some strikes, bypassing full congressional oversight. They argue these actions do meet the definition of hostilities and need formal authorization.
And there's speculation about a bigger strategy here, right? Related to Venezuela.
Yes, the military buildup in the region is fueling that speculation. The U.S. sent the USS Gerald R. Ford, a very advanced aircraft carrier, and its strike group down there. They've also put F-35 jets in Puerto Rico.
It's a lot of firepower.
It is. And it increases chatter that maybe the administration is gearing up to hit targets inside Venezuela, specifically targeting the Maduro regime's own alleged drug trafficking arm, the Cartel de Sols. The president denied a recent report about hitting land targets, but the military signal being sent to Caracas is loud and clear. The underlying argument might be that stopping the cartels ultimately requires dealing with the regime that enables them.
From the Caribbean to Africa now, President Trump also made headlines with a threat directed at Nigeria.
Yes, a public threat of potential U.S. military action there, citing concerns about the targeting of Nigeria's Christian population by Islamist groups like Boko Haram.
What exactly did he threaten?
He explicitly said he'd halt all U.S. aid and assistance if Nigeria continues to allow the killing of Christians. He even reportedly told the Pentagon to prepare options, saying the U.S. might have to go in guns a-blazing to wipe out the militants.
Is there evidence Christians are being targeted disproportionately?
It's complex. Boko Haram's main goal is an extremist Islamic state, and they mostly target anyone supporting the Nigerian government. But violence against Christians has definitely escalated, particularly in the north. One report estimated Boko Haram and similar groups killed around 43,000 Christians between 2009 and 2021.
How did Nigeria respond to the threat?
President Bola Ahmed Tinubu pushed back immediately. He said characterizing Nigeria as religiously intolerant does not reflect our national reality. He stressed that religious freedom is a core constitutional principle there. It's significant because Nigeria relies quite a bit on U.S. aid and military cooperation for its own security efforts.
Okay, one more foreign policy hotspot. The relationship with China, specifically on fentanyl.
Ah, yes, the fentanyl crisis. The U.S. is heavily reliant on China to stop exporting the precursor chemicals that Mexican cartels use to actually make the drug.
So it requires Chinese cooperation.
Absolutely. And it's a delicate diplomatic dance. After meeting with Xi Jinping, President Trump actually lowered some tariffs related to fentanyl precursors, down from 20% to 10%. He cited very strong action from Beijing to clamp down on the chemical flow.
But is the cooperation sustainable?
That's the huge challenge. Chinese chemical companies are apparently very adept at slightly altering chemical formulas, just enough to get around new regulations. It becomes this constant cat and mouse game.
And China probably doesn't like being blamed for the U.S. addiction crisis.
Exactly. They tend to view U.S. pressure as trying to make them a scapegoat for America's internal problems. That fuels their reluctance to fully cooperate. However, one area where there might be more common ground is money laundering. Chinese criminal groups are known to launder money for the cartels, and Beijing does want more control over its own financial system.
Meanwhile, what about Mexico? The U.S. has been putting pressure on them, too.
Intense pressure. And it seems to have yielded some results, at least temporarily. After Trump threatened big tariffs, Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, deployed about 10,000 troops to border areas.
And did that have an impact?
Apparently, yes. U.S. Sentinel seizures at the border dropped almost 50% in the fiscal year that ended September 30th. So it seems these pressure campaigns, controversial as they are, might be producing some tangible effects, at least for now, from both China and Mexico.
Absolutely fascinating overview of the global landscape. Okay, let's bring it back home now, shifting back to the intersection of consumer trends, investment, and big technology, starting with Whole Foods Market. It sounds like it's becoming, well, fully Amazonified.
Yeah, 8 years after Amazon bought them for nearly $14 billion, the integration is going way beyond just price cuts now. It's getting operational, cultural. Whole Foods CEO Jason Bouchel got promoted earlier this year. Now he oversees all of Amazon's grocery stuff. That includes the struggling Amazon Fresh and Amazon Go stores, too.
So no more separate grocery leadership.
Pretty much signals the end of that independent structure. And maybe even more symbolic. Whole Foods corporate staff. They officially become Amazon employees this December. That separate corporate identity Whole Foods had for decades. It's effectively dissolving.
Erasing the line between the original Whole Foods culture and the Amazon way.
Exactly. And you're starting to see it physically in the stores, too, which is where customers notice it most. In Philly suburbs, they're testing these ShopBots.
ShopBots? Robots?
Yeah, robots in the back room. They fetch non-Whole Foods brands, think Pepsi, Tide Pods, for customers who order through the Amazon app for quick pickup.
Ah, so you can get your conventional stuff via Amazon, picked up at Whole Foods, without Whole Foods having to actually put Pepsi on its main shelves and dilute its organic image.
That seems to be the idea. Pretty clever, actually. Addresses that customer need for a wider selection. And in Chicago, they've gone even further.
How so?
In the flagship Whole Foods there, Amazon ripped out the coffee shop and put in this big 3,800-square-foot kiosk right in the lobby called Amazon Grocery. And it openly sells conventional brands like Kraft Mac and Cheese right next to the main Whole Foods section.
Wow. Just right there.
Right there. As one market researcher put it, why let all those food dollars walk out the door when a customer needs conventional cleaning supplies?
Makes business sense, maybe. But how is this integration landing internally? Any friction?
Oh, major friction. This is where the culture clash really comes in. Current and former employees are complaining quite loudly about this Amazonification, saying the company's become too numbers-based, too focused on metrics.
Losing the original vibe.
Big concerns that this relentless focus on efficiency and data is killing the unique community-focused culture that defined Whole Foods since it started way back in 1980.
And it's hitting employees' wallets, too.
Tangibly. Corporate staff are set to lose their long-standing 20% employee discount after a year, and their bonuses. They used to be based on Whole Foods' performance. Now, they'll shift to getting Amazon stock instead.
That sends a clear message about where loyalty lies now.
Absolutely. Your future is tied to Amazon stock, not the grocery chain's success. The former co-founder, John Mackey, had that dramatic quote after he retired, didn't he? Said something like, "I married my daughter off to the richest man in the world."
Ah, that captures it perfectly. Idealism meets raw commercial power.
Okay, sticking with tech giants, let's talk about the money pouring into artificial intelligence. The spending is just astronomical.
Mind-boggling amounts. We're talking Meta, Alphabet, Google, Microsoft, Amazon. They all announced plans for massive increases in AI capital spending next year. Billions upon billions more going into data centers, specialized chips, hiring talent.
Hundreds of billions, probably, yeah. Across the board. Easily. But what's really interesting, and maybe a sign of some market sanity returning, is how investors are reacting. While they're excited about AI's potential, they seem to be demanding a real, concrete return on that spending today.
Not just promises about the future.
Exactly. We saw this play out really clearly last week with earnings reports. Alphabet's stock went up after they focused on selling basic, practical AI services that customers can use right now. But Meta's stock, it tanked 11%.
Why the difference?
Because Mark Zuckerberg spent a lot of time talking about pouring even more money into aggressive, speculative, long-term investment to build superintelligence way off in the future. No immediate payoff promised. Investors punished that approach.
So the market's saying, show me the money now.
Pretty much. And this reaction actually taps into some deep financial history. There's this thing called the investment factor, identified by finance professors Fama and French. Historically, companies that invest the most, have the highest capital spending relative to their size, tend to actually lag the market over time.
Really? High investment is usually bad for stock returns.
Generally, yes. The big exceptions were during major bubbles, like the Nifty 50 boom in the 70s or the dot-com bubble, times when the market loved pure speculation.
So the fact that Meta got dinged for its speculative spending suggests maybe we're not in a full-blown AI bubble yet.
It suggests investors are still prioritizing actual profits and quantifiable AI services today over just betting wildly on some distant technological singularity. There's still some discipline there, which is maybe healthy.
Okay, that discipline point leads to another fascinating question raised in the journal. Is OpenAI becoming too big to fail?
It sounds almost ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
OpenAI hasn't even turned a profit yet. Its annual revenue is tiny, like 2% of Amazon sales. But Sam Altman has engineered this meteoric rise, potential $500 billion valuation, based almost entirely on future promise.
So how could it be too big to fail if it's not that big in traditional terms?
The concern isn't about its current size. It's about systemic risk, drawing a direct parallel to the 2008 financial crisis. Remember, the worry back then wasn't just that banks were too big, but that they were too interconnected.
Right, through complex derivatives and things. If one went down, it could pull others down with it.
Precisely. And OpenAI is doing something arguably similar, but in the tech sphere. Altman has woven this incredibly complex web of massive deals with key tech pillars. NVIDIA for chips, Oracle for cloud computing. OpenAI commits to buying huge amounts from them in the future.
And in return, NVIDIA and Oracle invest heavily in OpenAI or give them favorable terms, locking them in.
Exactly. It creates this deep interdependence. So the worry is, what if the hype around artificial general intelligence, AGI, doesn't pan out? What if OpenAI's value collapses or shrinks dramatically?
They might default on those massive future purchase agreements.
That's the fear. And if they default, it could seriously destabilize major tech infrastructure providers like Oracle and chip makers like NVIDIA companies that are currently propping up large parts of the U.S. economy. It's an interconnected financial risk web, not just a single startup failing.
And the government plays a role here too, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The Trump administration has been very open about protecting AI development as vital for national defense and economic security. They're effectively helping to fuel and shield this AI boom. That political backing adds another layer, suggesting there's a strong government interest in ensuring companies like OpenAI don't fail.
So it's this combination of complex financial ties and political protection that creates the too big to fail concern, even for a non-profitable startup.
Yeah, it's a really unique situation. Yeah. Its stability, or lack thereof, could have ripples far beyond just the venture capital world.
Okay, fascinating stuff on the AI front. Let's leave the world of big tech infrastructure for a moment and explore some different areas. Global defense tech, some quirky economic policies, and a few human interest stories from culture and sports.
All right. First up, something we touched on earlier, Ukraine. There's been an intense focus on their drone technology, and it's attracting serious money.
Western investors are pouring in.
Rushing in is how the journal puts it. They see the war, tragically, as this real-time testing ground, a laboratory for rapid, effective innovation in defense tech, especially drones.
What makes Ukrainian tech so appealing?
Two main things. First, cost. Their drones are apparently a tiny fraction of the price of Western equivalents. One example given was a flagship drone from a company called Frontline, costing only $3,000. That's less than a sixth of its nearest Western competitor.
Wow, that's a huge difference. And the second reason?
They're battle-proven. These aren't theoretical designs. They've been used extensively and effectively in incredibly harsh conditions. They're seen as adaptable and reliable for modern warfare.
And this investment is changing these companies. They started small, right?
Many started literally in garages after the 2022 invasion. No. Now, this influx of foreign cash is helping them professionalize, scale up, and think about competing globally long after the war ends. One company, Swarmer, raised $15 million and plans to open offices in Warsaw and even Austin, Texas.
Global ambitions.
Definitely. And it's not just private investors. Governments are interested, too. The U.S., U.K., Denmark are reportedly negotiating deals to either share Ukrainian drone tech or even have these Ukrainian companies manufacture drones in their countries.
That's a total flip of the usual script, isn't it? Usually NATO gives tech to allies.
Complete reversal. It's a boom, for sure. But the article notes risks, too. Ukraine has historical issues with corruption. The domestic market is super crowded with over 300 drone makers now. And there's likely to be a major shakeout when the war eventually winds down. But for now, investors see a clear opportunity.
Okay, shifting continents and topics dramatically, let's talk about Argentina and its weird export tax.
Huh. Yeah, it is genuinely weird from an economic perspective. Most countries try to boost exports, often with subsidies. Argentina does the opposite. It taxes its most important exports. Soybeans, wheat, beef.
How heavy is the tax?
Pretty significant. Based on current prices, farmers are effectively taxed on 1 out of every 4 truckloads of soybeans they export. 1 out of every 10 for wheat. It's a major drag.
And this hurts their economy.
Massively. It's seen as a primary reason why Argentina's export sector is perpetually underdeveloped. This leads directly to their chronic shortage of foreign currency reserves and those recurring painful currency crises they always seem to be having.
How does it hurt farmers specifically?
It just squeezes their profit margins relentlessly. Because global markets set commodity prices, Argentine farmers can't just pass the tax on, they have to absorb it. This discourages them from investing in better seeds, fertilizer, new equipment, anything long-term.
Stunts growth.
Absolutely. The article notes soybean farming area in Argentina has barely grown since 2009, up only 8%. In neighboring Brazil, which subsidizes exports, it's up 118%. Huge difference.
And the new president, Milei, the libertarian, he wanted to get rid of this tax, didn't he?
Promised aggressively to scrap it entirely. Saw it as a major economic impediment.
Hmm.
But so far, he's only managed to reduce it on some things. Why? He desperately needs the tax revenue.
Ah, the classic political dilemma.
Exactly. The tax brings in almost 1% of GDP. He needs that money to try and balance the budget and crush inflation, which is the absolute cornerstone of his whole reform plan. It's easier politically to keep taxing exports than to make deep cuts to entrenched government spending programs. So the weird tax persists.
Fascinating policy trap. Okay, from national taxes to personal technology culture, fountain pens are making a comeback.
Apparently so. There's a dedicated global community, especially online. The main Reddit group for fountain pens has doubled in size in just 5 years, up to 368,000 users now.
What's driving the comeback?
Mostly, it seems, a new wave of much more affordable pens, often from China. They've lowered the barrier to entry, making it accessible beyond just, you know, wealthy collectors.
But this is causing some drama. Purists versus newcomers.
Big drama. The traditional enthusiasts, the purists who really value the history, the craftsmanship, and frankly, the high prices and exclusivity of luxury brands like Montblanc or the German maker Kaweco. They're reportedly fuming about this flood of cheap Chinese replicas.
Replicas? Like knockoffs?
Exactly. Knockoffs that often look, and apparently even write, almost exactly like the expensive originals, but sell for a tiny fraction of the price. One enthusiast mentioned having a $30 Chinese version of a high-end Mont Blanc that cost maybe $750, and saying the writing experience wasn't that different.
Ouch. How are the original manufacturers fighting back?
They're struggling. Kaweco, the German company, tried really hard to stop Chinese imitators by trademarking specific design elements and names. But it didn't really work. The knockoffs just reappeared under slightly different names or with minor tweaks. Highlights how incredibly hard it is to protect intellectual property in today's global digital marketplace.
The eternal battle. Okay, let's turn to investing itself now. We're seeing a new generation enter the market, Gen Z.
Yes, teens and people in their early 20s. They're jumping into investing in force, often using money they've earned from summer jobs or even side hustles. The article mentions one student funding her investments from a knitting business she runs.
That's cool. Are their strategies different from older generations?
They seem quite diverse, actually, and pretty pragmatic. You have some, like a college student named Kevin Hugh, who advocate for taking maximum risk while they're young. He invests heavily in volatile stuff like NVIDIA stock and cryptocurrency.
High risk, high reward thinking.
Yeah. Although, interestingly, he learned a lesson from getting burned in a crypto crash, lost 95% at one point, said it taught him the value of taking profits sometimes and not getting overconfident. But then you have others who are much more risk averse.
Like what?
Prioritizing steady, boring stuff like S&P 500 index funds, or diversifying with safer things like government I-bonds or treasury bonds as a hedge against inflation.
So not all just chasing name stocks.
Doesn't sound like it. Their motivation seems less about getting rich quick and more about achieving very specific long-term goals, like being able to afford a house someday or securing retirement. They seem to understand that just saving cash isn't enough anymore with prices being so high. Investing feels essential to them.
A pragmatic response to the economic reality they've grown up in.
Exactly. They see investing not just as a choice or a hobby, but almost as a necessity to achieve the life goals previous generations might have reached just through wage growth and saving.
Okay, speaking of careers and the workforce, let's circle back to something related to our first topic on layoffs. This strange, painful situation of the overqualified job seeker.
Yeah, this really ties into the corporate cost cutting and maybe the looming impact of AI. Mid-career professionals are finding themselves stuck in this awkward no man's land.
Oh, so?
They're seen as too experienced and therefore too expensive for the more junior or frontline roles that maybe haven't been automated away yet. But they're not quite senior enough for the top leadership positions, which companies often try to retain even during cuts. Middle management is getting hollowed out.
We saw that with the Amazon cuts, 14,000 office workers, a lot of middle ranks.
Exactly. And because companies are getting flooded with applications due to all these layoffs, employers can be incredibly picky. They worry that someone who looks overqualified on paper will demand too high a salary, or maybe worse.
They'll leave as soon as something better comes along.
Right. They see them as a flight risk once the economy improves. So this forces job seekers into this really counterintuitive and probably psychologically difficult strategy.
What's the strategy?
Recruiters are literally advising them to sell themselves short, to deliberately downplay their experience on their resumes.
Seriously? Hide your accomplishments.
Yeah. Suggestions include only showing the last 5 or 10 years of work history, not the full 20 or 25. And critically, removing graduation dates from degrees to avoid signaling age or extensive experience.
That sounds awful and potentially discriminatory.
The advice implicitly acknowledges that sometimes the overqualified excuse is just thinly veiled age discrimination.
You know, the idea of having to erase years of your professional life just to get an interview, that's got to take a toll. You spend decades building skills and a track record.
Only to be told you need to hide it. It's tough. Especially, as the article notes, for people who might genuinely want a less demanding role, maybe for better work-life balance. Like a program manager mentioned who took time off for parenting, he said he wished he could just tell employers he'd be perfectly happy taking a job that looks like a step down on paper.
But employers don't believe it.
They assume you'll get bored or want more money eventually.
Yeah.
And the irony. Despite this current glut of experienced people struggling to find work, one study projects the U.S. will face a shortage of nearly 3 million managers by 2032, precisely because companies are hollowing out those middle ranks right now.
Wow. So we're creating a future problem by solving a current cost issue. That offers zero comfort to people job hunting today, though.
None at all. It's a tough spot to be in.
Okay, let's wrap things up on a slightly lighter note with some highlights from the world of sports, starting with the New York City Marathon. Sounds like it was a big one.
Historic day, actually. Record-breaking stuff. In the women's race, Helen Obiri from Kenya absolutely smashed the course record. Finished in 2 hours, 19 minutes, 51 seconds, broke a record that had stood since 2003.
Incredible run. And the men's race was dramatic, too.
The closest finish in NYC marathon history. Benson Caputo, also from Kenya, won it by just 0.03 of a second. 0.03. His countryman, Alexander Mutiso, made this absolutely furious charge in the last 50 meters, but Caputo just held him off at the tape. Breathtaking finish.
Wow, you can't get much closer than that. Okay, shifting to baseball. The World Series wrapped up.
Yes, and the Los Angeles Dodgers did it again. Clinched back-to-back World Series titles. They beat the Toronto Blue Jays in a tense 11-inning Game 7.
The Dodgers, baseball's $350 million super team, they lived up to the hype.
They did. Despite having a lot of injuries during the regular season, their incredible depth and sheer talent really shone through in the playoffs. They found a way to win Game 7 5-4 in the end.
And there is a standout performance. A hero.
Oh, yeah. Their ace pitcher, Yoshinobu Yamamoto. He delivered what's being called one of the most improbable, gutsy Iron Man performances maybe ever seen in a World Series.
What did he do?
Okay, get this. He had already thrown 96 pitches just 2 days earlier, winning Game 6. His manager, Dave Roberts, had publicly said Yamamoto was completely unavailable for Game 7. Done. Needed rest.
Makes sense. Pitchers need recovery time.
Right. But then, in Game 7, with the title on the line, Yamamoto came out of the bullpen with 0 days of rest. Yeah. And he recorded the final 8 outs of the game, throwing another 34 pitches, just running on fumes and sheer will, apparently, to secure the championship.
Wow, after pitching 2 days before, that's unbelievable.
Absolutely unbelievable in modern baseball. He won the World Series MVP award for it. He was the first pitcher since way back in 2001 to throw back-to-back complete games, essentially, in the playoffs. Just an incredible feat of endurance and determination that helped the Dodgers get that second straight title.
What a story. Really shows that even with all the money and analytics, sometimes it just comes down to pure grit.
Exactly. It embodies that idea, doesn't it? Money buys talent, sure, but heart, determination, maybe defying conventional wisdom a bit. That's still what makes the best stories in sports.
What a dense and incredibly comprehensive dive this has been today. I mean, we've really covered the map. Global markets, corporate triumphs like Berkshire's earnings and that massive cash pile.
And then stunning failures, like the first brand's accounting mess and the questions around its auditor. We hit major political crises, the U.S. shutdown still dragging on, the Democrats wrestling with their identity.
Plus the really dangerous shifting global security picture. Gaza, the Caribbean, the tensions with Nigeria and China over fentanyl, so much happening there.
And then we looked at those fundamental changes hitting American life right now. That abrupt end to labor hoarding, the affordability crisis bringing back ARMs, the relentless integration of tech into retail with Amazon and Whole Foods, and how that impacts company culture.
But I want to leave you, the learner, with one final thought. Something that kind of pulls together what we discussed about corporate cuts and efficiency drives, and that immense, almost speculative investment pouring into AI.
Okay.
If you look back through history, right, every major technological leap, think the printing press, the steam engine kicking off the Industrial Revolution, more recently the digital revolution, they always cause massive disruption initially. Job losses, old ways destroyed. That's always the first thing you see, the most visible effect.
Right, the destructive part comes first. Karl Marx saw this with the Industrial Revolution. He marveled at how it unleashed these colossal productive forces, more than all previous generations combined. But his focus, his critique, was entirely on the destruction it caused, tearing apart old industries, old social ties.
Exactly. He saw the pain of the transition. But what history also shows, consistently, is that the prosperity and the new job creation that eventually followed these shifts dramatically exceed what was lost. Real wages, living standards, they ultimately soared.
The creation eventually outweighs the destruction.
So, considering the absolutely massive global investment we're seeing pour into AI right now, billions and billions, aiming for potentially transformative capabilities, the question for you is this. Are we, right now, entering another one of those periods, a time of truly colossal productive forces, like Marx described at the dawn of the industrial age?
And if we are, if this AI revolution is truly on that scale, how do we position ourselves as individuals, as a society? How do we focus on capitalizing on the incredible wave of productivity and wealth creation that might be coming instead of just reacting with fear to the displacement and the disruption that we're already seeing?
What policies do we need in education, maybe social safety nets, support for entrepreneurship? How do we absorb and maybe even accelerate this change for broad benefit rather than just trying to slow it down or block it?
A really profound question. Connecting today's corporate maneuvers and investment decisions directly to the potential shape of our future society.
Definitely something to think about. That brings us to the end of this deep dive. Thank you so much for joining us as we unpacked the critical news of the day. We'll talk to you next time.
Until then.